Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. That was Horace X, Darkness Falls, from their album Sackbut Folk Spoils Sunday. And before that, Dance de la Lemonade from one of the Doc's favourites, Rob Heron and the Teapad Orchestra. Well, some of you remember way back in January this year, I made an attempt to interview Tony, also known to the world as Computer Thugs, live on Skype on a show, and we spent 90 minutes or so juggling with the connection and having a generally pretty dire time of it. Me and Tony decided that rather than do it that way, we'd try and record an interview quietly on a Sunday afternoon and put it out as a recorded interview, which is what hopefully will happen this evening. We chatted with each other for a good 4 hours last Sunday about his time in the UK as called before he left here, and subsequently about his going out to Bali to develop basically his own teaching methods with a load of children out there. They don't have any real training or development or anything like that, and subsequently he got moved on to Thailand effectively, and all of this came about as a result, I gather, as a result of his contact with a longtime friend of his called Christian Helm, who inspired him really to do all of this stuff. Later on in the interview, later on in the chat on the Skype, we were joined by Christian, so towards the end of the show we'll be hearing from Christian and what he's been doing out in other parts of the world, as well as in Burnley, where they both come from. Now, we had pretty much uninterrupted 2 hours and 30 minutes of chat until Tony got onto a certain subject, and at that point the Skype connection fell away from us again, and as a result I had a bit of an interesting time editing the latter parts of this. I did actually have everything nicely divided up into easy to play chunks for me. For one reason or another, that's not the way it's turning up, so it's probably going to be as much of a surprise to me as it is to you, really. I think it's a great conversation we had. We cover an awful lot of ground. Tony's got a lot of things to say, and I hope that you enjoy listening to it as much as I enjoyed editing it and the actual talk itself. We'll probably take a break about an hour into the interview so that we can play a couple of tunes or so, go and get a cup of tea or whatever, and then we'll have to see how things fall out after that, see what it is I've ended up with. Hopefully it's going to be a pretty smooth gig, so being as there's plenty of it, we might as well slip straight into it. So here it is, the first part of a recorded interview I did with Tony, known to the world as Computer Thugs, at least until recently, last Sunday. And we kick off with Tony in the UK and talking about quite a lot, really, about the state of things generally. So I'll be back with you in an hour or so. I'll be in the chat box, and otherwise, it's my recorded voice. So here we are, talking, having another go at trying to talk with Tony. Some of you will remember that we had him live on the show a few weeks back, and we had loads of trouble with the Skype connection, but we've got a good solid one this time. So I've got Tony, known to many of you out there as Computer Thugs, to talk to me about his strange and exotic life since leaving England. Thanks for joining us, Tony.
Thank you very much, Dr. Rock, or may I say Nick.
call me what you like, as long as you don't infringe my rights.
Mr. Nick, oh, I'm only joking. Facebook actually deleted my profile as Computer Thugs, so I have a new profile for the people that have lost me on there, which is now called Cop-Muter Thugs.
Cop-Muter Thugs. Excellent.
Yes. I've changed the M and the P around. Yes, Cop-Muter Thugs.
Do those people ever give you any reason for why they're taking your profile down?
Well, my friend who's actually going to the Philippines and I'm meeting him, who's doing the next project with me, they actually blocked him as well. We think the reason for it was because we was releasing information on how charities actually operate, and how much CEOs were earning, and the fact that the money that was meant to go to these charities wasn't going where they said it were.
Yeah, that's becoming ever more evident, isn't it?
It is, and it's disgraceful, especially when you look back and you're going back as far as well, I can't remember actually the year, but 88, 87, and you look at Comic Relief, for example, and then years later you find out none of the money actually went to Africa, but it actually went on arms and other things for investment, as they call it.
Yeah, in fact, the whole Commonwealth, what was the Commonwealth Development Department, has been turned into an investment department now and is putting all the money in hedge funds. I've been reading about that myself.
Yeah, it's quite disgusting, actually, because everybody who's, you know, they're all donating, they're all putting, thinking they're doing some good towards helping other people in third world countries, developing countries, as I call them. I don't like to say third world countries, but developing countries. And then, you know, so many years later, you realise that the CEOs and the people behind these schemes have all got, they're driving around in the Jaguars, BMWs, and none of the money has actually gone where they've said it will.
As if they weren't stealing enough money off us as it already goes, eh?
Well, you only need to work out the fact that they have so many people going out doing door-to-door sales, as I call it, asking for people to donate every month, offering them an hourly wage and commission on top, which doesn't add up to the amount of money that is being donated every month. And you actually wonder how they can survive.
Yeah, certainly. And you managed to get all that information back up somewhere else, did you?
Yes, I've been doing my own research, and when we started revealing CEO names and how much they was earning, after all the things that I have put out there, they decided to delete me after 7 years with no right to appeal against the decision. I actually sent them my passport details and they still refused to give me access to my own account.
So once again, you're being treated just like livestock, eh?
That's all we are, Nick. You might as well just try and put it to the mainstream media and know for a fact that your information is not going to get out there.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's a good job we've got people out there who know how to work around it a little bit, eh?
It is, Nick, Dr. Rock. We'll keep calling you Nick, and you know I will. It is, yeah, and thank you for people like yourselves who are prepared to put the information out there, and there is enough people who are listening to alternative media, alternative radio shows, that understand how the mainstream media works.
I must admit, I barely listen to the mainstream at all anymore, and I am ever more impressed by the quality of the material that's coming out of internet radio, and there appear to be more and more really great stations running as well.
That's true. One of the things I'm really happy about is I gave up watching television longer than, I say 7 years, but it's probably a little bit longer. I don't listen to mainstream music. I try and listen to things that people are doing themselves, that's alternative, and I get to choose what I listen to. I get to choose what I want, not what the mainstream media is telling me to listen to or watch.
Yeah, I try to play. I mean, I do play some mainstream, a fair bit of mainstream music, but I'm constantly seeing bands and meeting them and dancing to them, and I'm playing more and more of their stuff as time goes by. And hopefully, eventually, that's all people will be getting from me is music by people that I've met.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I've done a website for one of my friends. He's along the same lines. He's a hip hop DJ. And more people are coming and listening rather than listening to the mainstream stuff. It's amazing when you can actually see the statistic, how many people are actually involved in the scene and jump in the bandwagon, so to speak.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, there's no excuse not for listening to alternative sources, because on the odd occasions that I do get subjected to things like Radio 1 and Radio 2, you know, in cafes and shops and the like, I'm absolutely appalled by how bloody awful it is.
That's it. They force things off on you, which when you look and you do the research yourself, you realise most of the stuff they are telling you is to divert your attention away than what is actually happening.
And to deceive us, really, about the nature of the life that we're living, even in the lyrics of the songs.
Well, one of the things that got to me that realised what they was doing was when the no smoking ban came into the UK. What they did was have so much publicity about the no smoking ban. Fair enough, they brought it in the summer and people were able to stand outside, but once it got to winter, then you realised how many of these public houses were closing down. What they didn't tell you at the time was at the same day the no smoking ban came in, they actually brought in another law which enabled them to listen and spy on every phone call around the UK without a warrant.
Really?
They've been doing that exactly the same day.
So it's a kind of one thing hiding the other, really. I mean, I suspect they've been doing that for a long time, and all they were doing was legitimising, to use the word carefully, legitimising what they were already doing.
Well, exactly. So now anything happens in the mainstream media and I happen to catch a glimpse of it, then I ask the question, what else is there going on? What are they hiding?
Yeah. Yes, indeed. Yeah, because they do hide a lot of it under a lot. And whenever they're making a lot of noise about anything, you can be absolutely certain there's something you do need to be paying attention to.
That's correct. Yeah. And we have to be aware. Everybody needs to look around. You need to do the research yourself. Don't believe everything you see on the internet. Don't believe everything you read. And don't believe everything that is in the media, because there is always deception.
Yeah. What sort of sites do you look at to keep an eye on these sort of things?
Well, you know, let's say I'm always keeping an eye out on one of these things, and I know maybe I'm going to open a few people's eyes up here, is one of the things is people are now realising that the OPT, or WPPPT, which is the other people's...
One People's Public Trust that stole the name of Darren's site, effectively, the People's Public Trust, didn't they?
That is correct. But you look at what they're trying to do, and if you realise the stuff that they were saying, come on. I remember the fact that in India, where it was actually a court in Malaysia, where they had a lot of leaders from around the world, and they charged President Bush, they charged Blair with war crimes. Come on, who's going to get near these guys? Nobody. Who's going to arrest these guys? Nobody. And the OPT are telling people, you know, we've foreclosed all these courts, we've foreclosed this, foreclosed that. And people need to look at what these people are actually doing. And the thing for me was they are giving information to paedophiles to help them get away and round the system against consent. Consent. I like the fact and what the Freedom Movement is doing and how it wants to operate. But people need to look at the full whole system. The fact is, if they actually taught law in schools, the law would work. But it's actually, how can I put this? It's corrupted. It's corrupted. Simple. I'm not saying the system doesn't work. What I'm saying is the system is corrupt beyond means. And they don't want people to know.
No.
And I can understand why I was wanting to be part of the Freedom Movement and everything else. But now people are jumping on the bandwagon, trying to get people down the garden path, so to speak. Where if we actually look at the system, you look at Liberty, PIE was Paedophile Information Exchange. It never disappeared. It changed name to Liberty. People need to look at this. And the fact they want to bring the age of consent down to between 14 and 10 years old, and the fact is that it's harder to prove consent, makes me ask questions on both sides of the boundary. I have to do this. I have to do it.
Yeah.
But as far, you know, as it is, we do. As far as my views are concerned, I was actually there is only natural law. But if there is only natural law, then it is even harder for us to prove that there has been consent between an underage individual. And before you know it, we might as well go to Sharia law and everyone can marry a seven-year-old.
Which seems to be the way we're going, to me.
Thank you. Thank you, Nick. I'm glad you're seeing it. And I have many Muslim friends that are on my side. Help me. They do the work that I aim towards, and they understand it as well. They don't want this. Now, the fact, you know, why are we being pushed towards these boundaries? Why? I ask myself, and I think to myself, is this towards the one world government? Is this to more publicity, more focus towards this Agenda 21, one world government, one religion? I don't know. But what I do know is, we need to look, and everybody has to question everything. Everything that comes there. In their minds, what they see, what they read. Don't just take a few websites for value of what it says and say, oh yeah, this is it. We need to actually look and research what is going on around the world.
And look carefully at the words that people are using, I think, because one of the things that alerted me to the OPPT and what it was doing was the fact that they kept referring to persons, and it was very much law dictionary language that they were using. And then one of the ways I think that's useful for spotting shills and infiltrators is to find out how careful they are with the language they use.
They're very careful, but there's somebody that I know, I've met the guy once. A lot of people don't like him, but he was the one to question these people, and they didn't want to know. They run a mile. And the guy is self-taught law, and he would put many of them to shame. And I know a lot of people don't like him, but I'm one of them that I'll just sit back and I will watch. And I will look and I'll listen and I'll learn. And if it probably wasn't for him pointing these things out to me, especially where it's opening the doors for paedophiles, I wouldn't have cared. I would have stood back and not really taken any notice and thought, good luck to you. But when you realise it, you wonder who is actually backing these people.
Yeah, and you were very much into the child protection thing when you were in still living on the Isles of Albion, weren't you?
I were, Nick, and you know yourself, I can't really say too much about it as we spoke earlier. You know a lot about me yourself personally, and anybody who does know me, they know about the work that we've been pushing forward for the last maybe 3-4 years. And I have my own reasons for doing this, and that is my number one priority.
And do you genuinely think that that expression on such subjects has been silenced genuinely because it might disadvantage upcoming court cases, or do you think that people are just trying to silence you?
Well, this is the question I've been asking myself for quite a while, and I am waiting for results. I have gone out there and posted information which has been questioned by higher authorities. But even there again, my Facebook profile never got deleted. I run the page Hackers versus Pedos on Facebook. We had a website. I've actually taken that down now. It's not live anymore. Because if there is a chance that some of these people, even one person, can get prosecuted, hundreds, and it could go into the thousands. It should go into the thousands. If they could get prosecuted, then I have to take the chance and believe that the system will work for us. Whether I believe in it or not is a different story. But I do have to believe that what I am doing is right. days, you know, and I back the other people what are doing, Stinson and Hunter. A lot of people don't understand or don't get to grips. So, but some of these people, let me say, Operation Save Kids. Yes, first you thought I was, it was a person involved with that, thought I was to do with something else, never understood any where I was coming from, questioned me lots. It's only in the last maybe month or so that I haven't really time to actually work among these people because of the work I'm already doing. But now we're starting to understand each other. And it's good because they're having to work with the system as well. There is no other system, Nick. We cannot work against it. We have to do this. And like I said, one, for me now, one of the biggest problems is if they're taught law as a subject in school, which we all know, right, for me, education is about programming, not about self-development. So this is what, as we're going to get on to further on in the program. But for now, if it was about self-development and if it was about each personal individual, I believe that law should be taught in school. This way, everybody would understand the situation around them and how to work with it rather than against it.
Because really, I think I accept the idea that the system as it stands, it's the people that are running it that's the problem, not the system itself. And we could none of us afford the amount of effort involved in rebuilding a whole thing anew. I do believe that what needs to be done is that we need, like you say, to use it and make it work properly. And let's face it, at the moment, it's not just law they're not teaching, or say meditation or relaxation or yoga or anything. I gather from the latest Agenda 21 vids I've been watching that they're not even really teaching maths anymore, or that they're teaching people that it bears no important relevance to the world.
You know what they're teaching? Climate change.
Yeah.
We need to get back to basics. We need to start and sort the system out again. It needs to go back. I can understand. I don't like the way the statutes work. The law works for corporations, so I can understand then how people want to go back and reset it. I don't think it needs resetting. I think it needs restructuring because it actually works. But a lot of these stuff is just there. It's for administration courts. We all know it, Nick. And if it was actually there for the people, we could make it work.
Yeah, well, if it genuinely was about not causing harm, it's quite clear generally when harm is being caused, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. For me, you know, I see both sides of the coin. I'm one of them people that will argue both sides of the coin. Even if I believe one side is right, I will argue the opposite side, just so that people open their minds a little bit. I want to live in the middle of nowhere. I want to have my own gardening patch and grow organic food. Not a lot of people do. Most people, I'm saying a large percentage, a hell of a large percentage, are happy being in their houses, doing what they're doing, having their Xbox, their PlayStation, their TV, being programmed. That is up to them. But it's how the program is working. For me, I want my little bit, but I'm not prepared to step out of the system just yet. I want to stay in the system and hopefully help to make it better.
Yeah, which is a highly worthwhile activity. I mean, to a certain extent, it seems to me that it's so difficult to get out of the system that we have to work within it to a certain extent.
Of course we do. People say, you know, I did it. I tried living without money for a year. I did quite well, actually, and I'm doing very well. But I'm not living off no money. I'm living off little money. But I'm appreciating things more, a lot more, than what I did when I was actually within the system and I was earning a lot of money. So, but that is my own personal choice. I'm not telling everybody they have to do that. People are happy within their own choices. people want to live in a system where there's no police. I'm sorry, it can't happen. What about in the areas in the world where, you know, I can say about England, look at Manchester. People are driving around shooting each other. You sure you don't want police on the streets? You know, I'm not questioning you, I'm just putting the question out there. We don't want police. Yeah, someone else said this to me the other day. No, it's, we don't want police, but we do want protection. You can't have it both ways. So let's work against the corruption. Let's make the system work. Let's, you know, let's develop it so that it helps everybody and not just the minority.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. And I, one of the reasons why I was keen to talk to you is because I feel the same as you do. When we decided to leave our Stone address and kind of basically hit the road, and we're still kind of wandering around the place, there are a lot of things that I miss. It is strange not having, you know, your own food store to go home to and not being able to gather stocks of fuel and things like that. But one of the
things... Fuel is a thing. This is what I call money. Money is a piece of paper. You can't feed chickens. You screw it up, throw it on the floor, chicken won't eat it. But what it is tokens. Doesn't belong to us, as we know. It's the property of the bank. But we need this because we cannot get fuel for cars. We can't... Beer tokens, whatever you want to call it, it's a token. But we need some kind of way to make the barter system work. The barter system works to such an extent that I love it. Because when I was in Bali, I lived off very little. Most of the stuff, I ate for free. I had a house for free. I had a motorbike for free. I still needed petrol. I still needed to get about. So without it, I couldn't have done it. So I understand it to a certain level, and yet when these other systems coming into play, I start to question it. And when I've realised, you know, I don't want to start naming names, but there's people out there trying to start their own banks up, and when you look into the systems and how they're going to work it, they're no better off than the other system, which we know, and you've been there, we've had these meetings, you've seen me question these people, they've got no answers, Nick.
No, I agree, they haven't. The basic problem with the, until the money becomes credit-based instead of debt-based, we're pretty much stuffed, really. You can change the name and the appearance of your bank as much as you like, but you need to change the nature of the currency.
This is it, but there again, it comes credit-based, and then we're starting talking about people being microchipped, we're starting talking about the banks having full control, there is no paper in play, so they know everything you're spending on anyway. I don't have a bank. I don't even have a bank over here, where I am in Southeast Asia. I use Western Union, I use MoneyGram. Okay, it costs. It takes the money away from me. But why should anybody know where I am spending my, I'm going to call it money, I hate to, tokens. Why should they know? What's it to do with these people?
Well, funnily enough, I was talking to Truth Juice Dave the other day, and he pointed out to me that that basically, whilst we're using IOUs rather than actual cash, everything we buy is in fact an act of fraud, because we're handing over a promise to pay, and not only do many of us believe we've paid, but we have no way at the moment of fulfilling that promise.
That's true. So therefore, how can this system be fixed? Because the only other way is, as you said, we have credit. If we have credit system, then everything gets paid and it's onto an electronic system where they know everything you're doing anyway. And this is one of the reasons why I give up my bank accounts in England. You go to the supermarket, they know exactly what you're buying, so they can market exactly to that person or to that pay bracket range or to the area that you're in. I see both sides of it. And I don't want to give up one for the other. I don't want to give up one to go and get microchip that I go and buy everything and give them a scan of my wrist. It's just, it's not plausible to me. I would rather have a barter system where I say to you, okay, you've got a pound of bananas, your friend's got a pound of potatoes, but I can fix your computers. So hang on a minute. So you need your computer fixed, and he needs a pound of potatoes, and we all exchange, but we still need some kind of exchange for the other things that we can't barter with. For example, petrol. alcohol, what cigarettes, you know, anything. And if you want to put it down to it, cannabis, whatever it is, it doesn't matter to me. But they still got that control over the whole system. Until they get rid of that and we found a way to get around that, we're still slaves.
And this system's only arrived fairly recently. I mean, I know when I was talking with Sinkro about her time in Nepal, she said that in the village she was staying, she was living for 2 years in a village that was absolutely in the middle of nowhere. It was like a day's walk over a mountain to anywhere else. And she said money was only just turning up in the village when she left, and that's 20, 25 years ago. And that they've been dealing without money all the way
exactly.
up to that point.
If you can get a farmer that's prepared to send maybe let's just give a typical number. Let's say 1,000 kilograms of whatever vegetables he's got and is able to, because at the moment fuel is only able to be bought by the dollar. Which is one of the things that Russia is on about, that if they go into competition with America and with all the things that are happening around the world, then they will collapse the dollar. And now I can understand what they're saying. But if we can only buy fuel by the dollar, if somebody could actually swap so much amount of vegetables or whatever their commodities are, and swap it for the fuel, and they did then exchange that for the local community to be able to exchange their services, then it's quite all right. But at the minute, we've not got that system in place.
So are you telling me that you have to actually have physical dollars to get fuel?
Yes, you do all over the world. Everywhere in the world, if you don't, the fuel, oil, as they call it, or petroleum, whatever you want to name it, depending what part of the world is. The only way it can be purchased, no matter what country you're in, is by the dollar.
Mm. Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because we know that the whole dollar and the Federal Reserve and all that kind of stuff is already run well over the cliff and is about to go crashing.
Well, we all know what the wars have been about over the last 10 years, so... But we're not going to get into that tonight, because
nope.
We'll carry on with me and you will talk for hours on that subject.
There is that danger, mate. There is that danger. So you
and I speak, and I've got friends that have been out in Iraq for 12 years, paratroopers that are now out of the army. They're actually still working there as close protection officers, helping people out there in Iraq, training them. On close combat, helping them to develop their own countries, who are telling me the war is not about poppies, it's not about heroin. But if you realise what it was about, and when you've been there long enough, it's about the oil pipeline to China.
Yeah. Yeah, although it must be said that it is useful to be able to protect the poppy fields and import it and start selling it to your own populations, isn't it?
It's all about control, not Nick. If people have no education, what you realise is what they're trying to do back home, especially when you come out to somewhere where I've been for the last 2 years. If you can keep people, if you can dumb down the education system, then you've got full control over the people. And this is, you know, why should it be that only people with money or numbers? Well, you know, why is it only these people should be educated? And the fact is, you know, you look at the people in these developing countries, and the fact that they don't have an education system compared to ours, then you realise why they are trying to dumb down the systems in England, America, Europe, everywhere, because it's control system. They don't want you to learn. They don't want you to know.
Mm, no, that's true. So you were a very busy and popular chap when you were living over here. Why did you decide to leave and what made you choose Bali?
Well, to get into it, there were six people die of cancer within 6 weeks of my family. pardon me, and I just decided that, you know, I'd had enough of the system, and a few friends, one of them that you know personally, he's not with us now, God bless his soul, Lockie.
Yeah.
He brought me into a different environment where I started to question the system. And there was a few people I met. You're one of the guys, you know. And, yeah. And I just thought, you know, what can I do? And when all this happened to me, that these people, I thought, I really want to do something helping people with cancer. And when I looked into it, you soon realise that, yes, why would pharmaceutical companies benefit from people being well? They wouldn't. They wouldn't. Why would... I forgot the number. It's something like 99677. If you Google it, you'll find there's a patent for a cure. I'm going to say a cure. I don't really use that word. But a cure for AIDS that has been available for the last 12 years that's been kept hidden. So for me, it was like looking into cancer. Why? And so when I spoke and I got in contact with Dr. Stephen Hopwood, I spoke to him and I said, I would like to help. I've had enough of the system and I wanted to get out of it. And I said, I would like to come down and work for you, but I don't want pain. What I do want is food, shelter, anything I need. But I will promise you, I will do the work that you need. So he agreed to it. So I ended up going down there and I set up the website, which is Totnes Cancer Care or Totnes Cancer Health Centre. They both go to the same URL. And I sat there and I worked 20 hours a day, probably longer, in the middle of the moors. And I worked to understand how, not just to do a website and get out of the system and move myself away from it and be hidden, but to understand what is cancer? Why do people have cancer? And how can we help treat, I'm not going to say cure cancer, because from 1939 we've always been told you cannot say you treat cancer by anything other than chemotherapy or radiotherapy. So we don't claim to treat cancer. We say we treat people with cancer. And the Trading Standards Office, the BBC, they all got on the bandwagon. We had to shut the website down for 12 months until basically we beat them. We beat them. We're doing nothing wrong. We ain't said we're treating cancer. We're treating people with cancer. And when people start to understand that we are exactly like plants, we are the same, then they will start to understand that what they're doing to their own systems can make a lot of difference to their own lives. For example, everybody who has cancer has a high level of candida. Candida is a high pH level of acidity. Now, anybody who has grown plants before knows that you to grow plants at a level of 5.6 to 5.8 pH levels, and that if it starts to go any higher, that the leaves start to go brown and they start to die and the plant starts to die. When you ask alkaline the plants and the system, it grows back. It heals itself. And once I learned more and more about how the system works and the human body, then I started to understand. And we actually, you know, they're all saying none of this is proven. Why is it not proven? Because they won't let these tests be put out there. And I've worked with Dr. Stephen Hotwood, Dr. Verkirk, Barbara Wren, who's the founder of the College of Natural Nutrition. They started making a lot of sense to me. And one of my friends had skin cancer, and I talked to him and I explained to him about his diet. He bought a book. He spoke to Dr. Stephen Hotwood, and he followed everything. He followed it to a T. And what I can say is he went to a Chinese herbalist. He spoke to him. He did his own research. He didn't just listen to me. He did his own research, and he said, it actually makes sense what you're saying. So he stopped buying produce, which was basically full of additives and things that, you know, people don't even look at what is on these things. And he started, if you wanted a pizza, he made it fresh. He did it himself. If you wanted, you know, he wanted a curry, he got all the vegetables, he did it himself. He stopped buying all this pre-made food with all these extra additives and everything else. And I really thank him. And he got back to me not long ago, maybe 6 months ago, and said, I've got the all clear. And he was clear. He didn't have to go for chemotherapy. He didn't have to go for radiotherapy. He did what his heart told him. And for me, it's not about a cancer cure and whatever. If people actually look, because there is no cure for cancer, there's that much, nearly said the word, I'm not going to swear if we're going to go on air. There's that much chemicals in the things that we are eating. Aspartame, I can go on and name thousands of them. But if these chemicals that they are producing, which are byproducts of GMO products, and so for instance, yeah, as I've just said, aspartame, which is not sugar, you might as well, you're better off having a ton of sugar in your coffee or your tea or whatever. Realistically, natural sugar. But when it, you know, if people start to look at cancer prevention rather than a cancer cure, then everybody would be much better off. So I went down to work for the doctor, and I decided, you know, that this is what I want to do. I want to help people. I'd already done a soup kitchen, should I say a community kitchen? So I won't say a soup kitchen, because that then denounces the people that came. But what happened was we run a system for 3 days of Christmas, me and my friends. We all work together. I'd like to say a big thank you to, I'd like to name all of them, but there was quite a lot. somebody just said to me, what are you doing over Christmas? And I said, I don't know. I might do a soup kitchen. Before I know it, I had 30 people asking me what I'm doing and can they help. And after that, I contacted, yes, including supermarkets, including, you know, all the different businesses, because it's better to be fed than not fed at the end of the day, you know. So, but I did go to the market where there was, it's all organic vegetables, and I knew some people are vegetarian, some people are not, so you cater for both. So I went to the butchers and I asked them, and before we knew it, we had so much food that we lasted for 3 days basically, and we went round to refuges where battered women refuges with children, a lot of homeless people, and they come, but they was invited not just to, they didn't want to come and sit there and eat, because then that segregates them from everybody else. So what they did do was came and helped prepare the food, got involved with the community, and made everybody feel equal. You know, you don't want to feel like you're segregated from everybody else.
That's brilliant, that, isn't it? The way the veg people and the butchers and everything, I mean, people are so decent, they really do want to help. And then people who spend a lot of their time apart from everybody else.
It wasn't just them. Warburton. One of my friends, he was working for Warburton. He put it towards them. And they dropped us off. I'm not joking, maybe 20 trays of bread. Bomb tea cakes, we call them up the north. Bomb cakes, baps, whatever you want to call them, depending where you're from. Brown bread, white bread, they give us everything. The only thing that we spent was £10 on tea, coffee, and milk, sugar. You know, just the little thing. That is the only things that we spent on 3 days of helping the homeless. People asked me, they said to me, what did you do at Christmas? And I couldn't talk to people. I couldn't tell them. Because when you see a child smile for a meal on Christmas Day, when everybody else is getting PlayStations, Xboxes, it gives you a lump in your throat, Nick. It really does. And for me, that was my turning point. I'd already had a public house a couple of years before and invited everybody who was an old-age pensioner to come for dinner and did a big dinner for everybody, give them free drinks. You know, but when I did that, I can't believe in England you get... It's meant to be one of the richest countries in the world. But when you've got a child smiling for a meal on Christmas Day, it breaks your heart. It really does.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because it might be one of the richest countries, but the people in it are certainly not all the people in it are wealthy, by any means.
Well, look at it, and it's getting worse. The rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer. And when you look at what's happening to the systems, I am really, really happy to not be part of it.
Yeah.
In fact, it's better for me to be helping a system where, you know, I'm living in countries and staying in places where corruption is rife. But the fact is the corruption is in front of your eyes. And when you realise about the system they're living in, you understand the corruption. Now, when you get into England, the corruption is hidden. It's not in front of your eyes. And it's all to such an extent where you can see that they're making the rich richer, the poor poorer. And it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking that people like my mother, they're having to be, you know, they're part of it. It's heartbreaking when you see old age pensioners that they can't afford the heating. They're dying of a pneumonia. You know what? Where I come from, which is Burnley, very proud. Very, very, very proud of what's going on there. People now are, you know, helping and doing their own things. And they can call it a charity. It's not a charity that they've set up. But these people are actually going out into the streets and trying. And people have got online asking for carpet, furniture, bedding, anything. And they're taking it right. Over Christmas, the amount of things that they did for people, I always say to people, I'm saying, we wish we could do what you're doing. It's not about what I'm doing, because I'm able to do this. Some people have, you know, they have mortgages, they have children, they have jobs. They're not in the position to do what I'm doing. Mm. So for me, it's about not what I'm doing. You've got an 80-year-old neighbour next door. Knock on his door. Ask him, does he need something from the shop? Is he warm enough? Does he need anything? Or she? You know, it's about helping each other. And all I see these days is people sat on the mobile phones, no communication, and just sending messages to each other on Facebook when they sat in the same room. What happened to community? There is no community. Yeah, you're laughing, but you can see my point.
I can see your point exactly. Yeah, yeah, I'm utterly sympathetic. I really am, you know, because it's... It's great to hear that that's happening, though, because, you know, perhaps we've reached the bottom and we are going to see a resurgence of community, which is one of the emphases of my shows, is to try and encourage and find ways of rebuilding it, because it's the thing we need more than anything else, is to be together.
Well, one of the things, I don't know whether you've seen it, I know you're not a Facebook fan or anything like that, neither am I, but I use it because of my job, search engine optimization and marketing, and especially the work that I've been doing, because my family and friends, they all want me to keep them up to date. And, you know, that is, for me, it's the way of communication, but I'd rather people chose a different way. The fact is, you can't lead, you cannot lead a horse to water. You can't. You know, they've got to do it themselves. You can lead them to water, but whether you get them to drink is a different situation. So there's this thing that's been going around, and I think, I'm not sure now, it was 1, 2, 3, 4, but there was this thing called NEC nomination, which was flying around on YouTube and social networks, where people were daring some of their friends to actually do better than they did in what they drank a pint of. I'm not going to say what they were drinking, but it was ridiculous. It was actually disgusting. But there was, I'm not sure how many people, but there was there's been a few people died over the last few months.
Yeah.
For me and a few friends, what we've decided to do, so I'm gonna tell you about it because I didn't want to, but anybody else does it, fair play to them, but they've heard it here first. So what we're prepared to do is there's me and a few friends which are going to chip in. Believe me, I ain't got a lot, so if five of us chip in £20 each, we're going to go to a place in Bangkok where we know there's probably a few hundred homeless people. And instead of neck nomination where people are drinking stupid shit, sorry, I've swore, I tried not to.
That's all right, we'll let you off, mate. Yeah,
no problem. So instead of doing something like that and daring somebody to beat what I've drank, so it's a pint of whatever mixed with PP or anything else, what we're going to do is a scoff nomination. So we're going to go to this place within the next, I hope it's within the next week, or it will be just after I come back from the Philippines. I hope my friends do it without me while I'm there. But so we're going to go, we're going to feed over maybe between 100 and 200 people, which between us here is not a lot of money. But what we're going to do is say, right, we're going to scoff nominate, and whether it's Pizza Hut or whatever within a certain area, then we're hoping that they will say, okay, we will donate 10 pizzas to this homeless charity. Or somebody will say from a shop, okay, we'll donate this, we'll donate this, and film it, and then they nominate the next town and a different company that provides food, shelter, and hope this spiral as much as what it did with people being stupid with alcohol.
Great idea. I really look forward to hearing how that goes, if you can keep us informed.
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, we've sat there and we've thought about it. How can we make this work, but in a different way? And the way, you know, the neck nomination went viral, wow, all over the world. Why not do it with food instead of people being stupid and killing themselves with alcohol? Why not go and feed somebody? Why not give somebody a meal? Why not go and give somebody a blanket, make them warm?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a grand idea. It is. Are you still there?
Yeah. I just took a second out then, you know.
Yeah.
I'm a bit passionate about it, you know.
So was it... it was your desire to help then, and the nature of the so-called United Kingdom, was it, that made you decide to go and try somewhere else?
Well, I was speaking to a lot of people and close friends about me wanting to help go to different countries, developing countries. I've never been a teacher, and I just wanted to help people, especially children. It's something that's always been in my heart, and we developed an operating system, which is called Kidify. We have a business. There's quite a few of us from around the world, so I'll just get back to how we got there. There's quite a few of us. We work on a site. I don't like to use the word hacking, but we're development, coding, not just that. We help everybody with their situation to do with electronics, the internet, as much as we possibly can. So over the last 7 years, we've been working together and we've become a really close-knit community. Now, the website is called Succo. It's succo.com. No, it's not a porn site. The name comes from one of my friends He's the owner of the website, and the name comes from, if you do you remember Beavis and Butthead, Nick?
I do. Well, I remember hearing about them. I'm not sure I ever actually saw them.
No, well, they used to have this really stupid laugh, and it was like, suckle, suckle. So that's where my friend got the name from. So, you know, we like things that are going to stick in people's minds rather than pick something that's, you know, it's got to be something that sticks out there.
Well, it has, so, to, be said, has to be said, mate, that sucko.com would certainly do that, eh?
Definitely. So we were working together for quite a while, and we said, you know, what are we all doing? And we talked and we communication. Yes, the word communication. So there again, community. Get off your Facebook. Get off your social networks. Go and knock on your next door and say, I've lived here 5 years. Do you know my name? It's true. So I actually posted an image today. It says, yes, we do have Wi-Fi, but it's crap. Turn your phone off and start communicating. I loved it. It was brilliant. So we started, we worked together. We set up a company together, which is called Rusty Tub. Yes, that's why Rusty Tub? Because people contact us and the computers are broke or the servers are broke or, you know, so we get there, we say, it's like, who set this up? It looks like. You know,
lost you there for a minute.
All right. So with a few of us from Succo, we decided we wanted to set up a business together, and we we were already doing it, but separately. So we put our skills together, and we started doing web server penetration testing. Yes, penetration testing. But it sounds better than hacking. So securing people. Yeah, I know it's still not good, but that's the actual name for it. So we're developing networks, search engine optimization, helping people develop their online presence, if you will. So we've just released one, actually, last night, which is for my local area, which is called freebusinesspages.com. This is for local communities, and we are going to eventually add every single town within the with every country around the world. But this is for communities to start communicating with each other. You can link it up to your Facebook account, your Twitter account. It will help your own search engine optimization. But this is something we've looked at. One of my initial thoughts was setting up a website to help organic farmers. But if we look at the bigger picture, then communities, if they work together rather than shopping in places like supermarkets, where I was actually working as a marketer for one of the big supermarkets. And the Rames are, what they do is they have different areas within the supermarket. So you've got your butcher's department, your fresh food department, your grocer's department, your deli department. And what they do each week is they have these special offers on, and they try to get the workers to get the best percentage, to get the best markup rate, when actually no one's going to ever win. They swap it round each week where to create the competition, and you're just a slave. Where what their purpose is to shut down six small businesses within a certain industry every week. So eventually, there will be no small businesses. You will have to buy from a corporation. Simple. That's what it's about.
They've already really achieved that in some places over here. I know there's some places where I've been where you're hard pushed to find anything other than, you know, the four main supermarkets. There ain't any little shops. And there was hundreds of them when I was a kid, especially in Leicester and the Midlands, you know.
Well, where I worked, it was a booming industry. You had a lot of people that could be self-employed. Now they don't want you self-employed. Now you have to have a license. Now you have to do this. Now you have to do that. If you're not doing it, go and work for a corporation on minimum wage. You're not allowed to lie. And if you are in a business, they're doing their best to shut you down and get rid of the middle class and make you working class.
Yeah.
It's disgusting. It really is disgusting. And until people start shopping local and supporting local businesses, it's going to get worse. It is going to get worse. But people are starting to wake up to this. You know, so whether it's too late, I don't know.
It's still worth the game. The game is still worth the candle, in my opinion. I mean, there's other things going on here now as well. We had Mark Windows on a while back telling us that the Waltham Forest Council is basically doing all the small businesses for things like envirocrimes, which involve putting their bins out on the wrong day and things like that. And they don't do that to people like Starbucks and Kentucky Fried Chicken and stuff. They only do it to the small local businesses. And that's like a pincer movement, if you like, between the supermarkets and the administration.
Yeah, this is why these big companies... Starbucks is one of them. I can go on. We all know Tesco's is another. They don't pay the tax. They would rather not reveal their information, their books, as everybody else has to do, but rather pay the fine because it's less than the tax they would have to pay.
Well, so also,
who's the winner?
Over here, it is certainly quite clear when you look at it that the government is making this place basically a tax haven for people. It's not even really trying to charge people like those major companies tax anymore. In fact, it's offering them breaks to set their accountancy facilities up in London.
And what they're saying is, oh, we're creating jobs. Sorry, you're creating 1,000 jobs for minimum wage while you've shut down 2,000 jobs. You know, it goes around and it's... People are starting to... One of the things that I did like, and people couldn't believe that there was actually riots in Bristol because of the Tesco Extra opening. You know, where I come from, I think there's 4 or 5 supermarkets. But what used to be a booming industry for local businesses is now non-existent. Mm. It's disgusting. It really is disgusting.
So how did Rusty Tub end up with you exporting yourself?
Well, my thing is, like I said, it was for helping children and I wanted to, do something different with my life. So I'd been working at the cancer centre and he sent for Dr. Stephen Otwood, and after a year, you know, he provided me with my needs of what I, you know, so I worked. I worked really hard. No one can say I always worked very hard. And I put the work in. I wore 20. I don't watch television and things like that.
You don't bloody sleep. You don't sleep, mate. I've seen you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I enjoy my job. It's not just a job. It's a hobby. So he said to me after a year, what do you want? What do you need? And some friends that I know, they said to me, look, we're out in Bali. Get yourself out here. We're going to help with teaching children and, you know, we're going to put all these things in place. Not mentioning names, but you know quite a few of them. Mm-hmm. And I actually really looked forward to doing it. So I said to the doctor, he says to me, so I need to give you something. What can I give you? And I said, I don't know. All right, then. Ticket to Bali. He said, what are you going to live on? I said, I don't know. £200 a month will do. Because I did work for a lot, and he said, well, if you keep up the work that I've been doing, if I can do it for him while I'm there, he said, there's not a problem. So I said, well, get me a ticket, first of all, for a two-month holiday. I said, I'll go, I'll check out what they're doing, I'll check out the system, and if I'm happy, chances are I won't come back. So I went to see my family. I said, look, there's an opportunity coming up that, you know, I've dreamed of for the last 10 years, which is going out helping in developing countries. So my family said, yeah, okay, no problem. Realistically, they thought I'd last 6 months. In fact, they thought I'd last 2 months and I'd probably be back home. And then my brother said to me, well, I didn't think you'd last 6 months. But I'm still here.
Yeah.
So I came out and I came to Bali. Well, I went to Bali, should I say. And I'd already visited Bali in, I think it was 2007. So when I got here, I told them what my friends were doing and that I wanted to do it in their village. So I went to see the head of the village, the head of the bank, how I wanted the system to work. People that knew me, that would trust me and would let me attempt something that has not been tried there before. So when I met up with the friends eventually and I said, okay, I've already put the system, I've seen the people that matter, they've said we can put this system in place. So for 4 or 5 days, I followed their lead, but I wasn't happy with what they was doing. What they were doing was a system for adults, not children. But not saying it was wrong, what I'm saying is it wasn't right for children. So I took the system that they developed and I tried to develop it towards my own attitude and towards children, which, okay, would take a little bit longer, but give it a little bit of time, I actually believed in my own heart I could make it work. So these people there, they agreed to it and started off and said to, you know, I will help teach the education system in Bali. You have to have an education system. They try to provide schools up until children are 12 years old. But in the villages where children are in the mountains, it's very hard. So there's a lot of places where children don't get an education. Or after 12 years old, when education becomes a system that you have to pay, in England you don't. All right, you do at university, college. Okay, I don't agree with it, but there is a little bit of help. This should change the system. For me, education, if you are prepared to learn, education should be free. You know, I understand that there's teachers need paying, there's lecturers need paying. But as the system goes, it's just way too expensive. So as it's gone on from when I went to university and I went to college, it's just become so impossible for people to get a higher education that they have to go to work. They give it up.
So I wouldn't do it now. I wouldn't do it.
Exactly, Nick. So for me, it was like, you know, in a place like this where they don't want you to have an education, just as they don't in England, but people don't realise it, these people have a basic education. Yeah. The government owns, you're going back in England, you're going back 100 years where you can sign your name and count. So you sign in, we all know what a signature is, and as long as you can count to pay your taxes, no problem. And that's what the system works like. So for me, it was like, if you can go and if you can give these children a chance, not just a chance, but give them confidence. You know, give them a dream, because if I didn't have a dream, I wouldn't be where I am now. And I followed my dream. So I do thank the system in a way, because I wasn't an angel in school, but I do thank that I had the chance. And if I hadn't have had the chance, I would not be here today.
Yeah. Yeah, it is what you make of it, isn't it?
It is, it is. So I started off and they said they agreed to what I was going to do. So I said I will do it in the open. The parents can come. Everybody can come. Everyone can see what I'm doing. Everyone can look. And I did it and I started on the beach. And I've always said you don't need four walls to teach as long as it is a little bit hot out there. You know, it can get up to 40 degrees, sometimes hotter. And what I did was adapted this advanced learning system to my own attitude. And as you can tell now, I've got a lot of passion about what I do. So what I did was I developed this passion to give energy, because that's what the world is. To me, it's energy. And for me, when most people, children especially, if they're in education, they're in class, they're bored, so they go to sleep, they don't learn, they don't want to learn. You know, in England, it's like, I don't want to go to school, want to play on my PlayStation. But over here, they want to learn. They actually want to learn. So it made everything 2,000 times easier.
And a lot more fun, I'd guess, as well.
Well, you know me personally, Nick, and I can be serious, yeah, but most of the time I'm having a joke, having a laugh, and I put that into the education system. I hate to call it teaching, mentoring, so encouraging the children. And for me, it wasn't about teaching, it was... it was teaching English was number two, or computers, business studies, whatever we're teaching, that was number two. My first priority was to teach the children confidence. If you are confident, you can learn anything. It's just about being alert, being awake, and having a bit of interest. If you can develop that into children where you make them happy, you make them want to listen, they will expand beyond your imagination.
Yeah, and of course the opposite's true as well, isn't it? If you're dismissive of children and stuff, you can do untold damage for quite a long time.
Well, I actually had an argument with one of the parents out there, because he turned around and said to me after a month or so, he said, "Is my son still stupid?" We were sat in front of quite a few people, adults, children weren't there. And I lost my rag a little bit. And I shouldn't have gone as extreme as I were. But basically what I said to him was, don't ever, ever, ever call that child stupid. If you tell a child enough time that they are stupid, they will begin to think they are stupid.
Yeah.
So for me, it was, they are absolutely, these people are brilliant with their hands. The fact is, they're not given the education what they want. So if you give it them, they will learn. If they're not given it, they will just stay in the same position all the time. They don't want these developing countries to develop. They're happy with having the system with such a segregation that the rich are rich and the poor are poorer. You know, which is what is happening in England. And America, Europe, they have realised that people have started being able to develop themselves and now are trying to change the education system to make it so that it doesn't happen. In fact, they're knocking it back 100 years. It may take them 10, 20, 30, 50 years to do that, but they want it as it was 100 years ago. They don't want you to learn. They want it so only people... we have got such a stature within the system, are able to have this knowledge, which is what law is all about. Once you get to a certain level of law, you've got everything you need. This is why they don't teach law in schools.
Yeah, yeah. So did it go well? That was it a successful venture for you and the children?
Well. Put it this way, I started off with one place, I started, and like I said, I started with no money. I bought the books, whiteboards, markers, fruit, water. Fruit and water is important because in hot countries like these, the brain shrinks by 30%. So then if you give them rice, they start to feel sleepy. Then they go to sleep, so they're not learning nothing. Give them energy. Make them feel alive. I didn't want a kid in a class where they were bored because they had to sit there and write. I made them shout, scream, jump up and down. I made it so much different that these children really enjoyed the classes that I was giving. And before I knew it, there was priests coming to me, which they're called Pak Duro, which is the name they're given in the Hindu community, which is basically that it's the head priest of the community. I also had the head of the villagers coming to me and saying, can you come to our village? So it wasn't about me going to these places and saying, oh, I'm going to do this, because they don't know you from Adam. I started somewhere where I actually knew people, and the rest of it was all by invite. So before I knew it, I was teaching more than 12 destinations all over the north of Bali. And with the help of somebody, Kadek, who was one of the local guys, was registered as a school so we could give certificates. So we did it all above board, and we made sure everything was properly done, but it was different to how anybody else had ever taught there. And I had more than 30 volunteers. I had internships from universities. It was a fantastic experience that unless you experienced it, you could never understand it.
It sounds brilliant. It sounds like a community actually formed itself around you and your enthusiasm.
It did. The idea was it's pay it forward. So the older children, 13 to 19 year old, they were the first group that we started teaching. So once they got to a certain level of English and it needed to be improved and go higher, then I said to them, okay, who can use a computer? They all went, no. I said, who uses Facebook? Me, all of them. So you can't use a computer, but you can use Facebook. I said, okay. And I asked them, okay, what's your ambition? It was all to be a fisherman or work in the parents' little shop, which sold noodles and rice. And it was like, you know, come on, you can have bigger dreams than that, you know. But they were actually, realistically, that's what they were doing, looking at things realistically. So I said to these guys, listen, I will help you. And I will teach you computers, I will teach you business management, marketing, I will teach you how to fix a computer, how to build a computer, how to build a website, all in different little groups, so that you all work together in their own little community. But what I did say is for me to teach you for free, you have to teach for free. So therefore, I took two of the students every day, two different ones every day, and therefore, they become the teachers to teach the younger students, and I just become the guide. And they taught them what I taught them. So this is how it become paid forward. So it started to expand. And when I realized that it was working was when I was at an area where I was teaching some children. And one, I said, no, I don't want children below the age of 5 because trying to keep them in the age group. I don't want people to get behind. It's hard when you're on your own. I have teachers that come. They said, can I volunteer? And I said, yes, of course you can. I would love it for you to do. Come and see how I do it. Give it a week of watching me and helping me. If you want to develop it into your own system, I'm quite happy to help you. And when I asked the teachers, which are qualified teachers in different countries around Denmark, Sweden, Switzerland, all over, and I said to them, okay, do you want to do class today? No, we're just here to help. They wouldn't do it. And I actually do, but it's because I do it a different way, Nick. It's like, you know, I would go sometimes and I would be so tired, but I was doing it 7 days a week. And Cadet actually said to me, you need to take a day off for yourself. And I said, no, this is what I came here to do. And some days I'd get there and I'd be so tired and I didn't really want to do it. I wanted a day off. But once I started, children give you that much, you know, it's not like sit down, write this. Once you started and you felt the energy of the children, it just like, it boosted my system to such an energy level that sometimes the class was meant to be, I do it now, I should teach for an hour and it ends up to 1.5 hours, maybe 2 hours. And it's because I don't care about the time. I'm happy with what I'm doing. It's not a job. It's my hobby. This is what I've dreamed about. And it's actually working. And I can't explain. The only people that you could ask about it, and they're not online tonight. Last time we tried to do the interview, there's a few people about which wanted to come on and explain to you and say, listen, I went for a week. I was there for a month. I was there for 2 months. You've got to see it to believe it.
Well, do put them in touch with me because I can talk to them separately, you know.
I will do. I'll definitely do that. Thank
Brilliant.
You. Because when you speak to people, you know, like I said, I'm passionate about it. So you can tell with how I'm talking about it. And everybody I've spoke to says to me, we can tell what you're doing. We can hear the passion in your voice. And I was going into places in the mountains where they'd never even seen, they call them, in Bali it was a bully, in Thailand it's a farai, never seen a white person, never seen a tourist. And they were like, oh, with their mouths wide open, in shock. And they were so shy. And like I said, it's not about teaching them English or that is not what I wanted to teach them. But I learned with them, with me teaching them English, they taught me Indonesian. So within less than 12 months, I was speaking fluent Indonesian. And for me, I was able to travel into the mountains, go sit down. I was invited to houses. And like I said, I was there off £200. It wasn't enough to live off. But after, people said to me, you'll not do it. You can't do it. It's impossible. And I thought, well, you know, we'll give it a couple of months. We'll see how it goes. And after 2 months, I had a house for free. I was getting food for free. I had a motorbike for free. I had everything I needed. The only thing I paid for was food. Yes, I smoked. It was cigarettes. Yes, I had a couple of drinks. So, you know, that was the little thing. But the money that I paid for was stuff for the children. They couldn't give me money. They couldn't pay me, as in European wages. It was impossible. So what they did do was provided me with my needs to be able to stay there and support my living costs without actually, you know, giving me a living. If that's the best way to put it, really. So, you know, people said, you can't do this. And then after two months, people said, can't believe this. You know, even the local people said, that I knew from last time I was there, when I told them what I wanted to do, they said, we actually went to Wearport. You've got no chance. Impossible. You're not going to do this. And then after that couple of months, they come back and they said to me, well, you proved us wrong. You know, you are actually still here. I said, you know, and fair play on you. You've actually proved us wrong. And thank you. And like I said, it just went from one. It just expanded and expanded and expanded. And what got me was after the few months of being there, I had to leave the country and go to Singapore. What I had to, was to get a visa. So Cadet said he would sponsor me and I would get a 6-month social visa. Never looked into it. I just thought social means I can come back and social, yeah, means I can help people socially. So I went to Singapore. I could have flown home on the Monday. a person that we know mutually, doesn't matter who, let me down, and I didn't have any money come from Dr. Steve, which should have been sent over, and said that, no, I want you to come back, you know, this is it. And I thought, well, I sat there and I thought about it, and I said to myself, if this is not meant to happen, it won't happen. So I thought, I've got a choice. I either get my flight back home, because it was going from Bali to Singapore on the Monday, so I could have jumped my flight from Singapore, and it all been over, or I take a risk and have enough, just about, with basically a meal, 50 pence, bit of petrol, 30 pence, and get back to where I were, and know for a fact that the people in that area would make sure that I was okay. So I took that chance, stayed an extra day, and I didn't tell anybody for a while, but I said to the priest, you'll not believe what happened to me. And I'm not religious, Nick. I'm quite agnostic, really. I'm not saying there is. I'm not saying there isn't, but somebody proved to me, and fair enough. But I don't know. I've never died. At least not in this life. So if I did in the last life, I don't remember. So this lady walked up to me, and she was disabled, and she asked me for some money, and I was sat outside the bus stop, outside the place that I was staying, the one of these centres that, you know, you share a room with 12 people. And I went outside to have a quick cigarette, and I sat there and I thought, shit, whoops, said it again. I swear it. But you know, I just thought, what am I going to do if this all falls through? I am really up the crapper. And I'd already asked people and said, please, you know what I'm doing. Please help support me. I need a ticket to go to Singapore. And I got my friends supported me, and they paid for my ticket. You know, donations of £10, £5, £2, £1. The ticket was, I think, was £100. So I was lucky that people had noticed what I was trying to do and supported what I was doing. So
that's the best testimony you can get, really, isn't it?
It is, and I just thought, if I'm meant to do this, I'll get back. If not, well, I'm just going to say to people, look, I'm up the crapper. Who can chip in? I've missed my flight home. It's £400, whatever it would be. Please help, get me home. And in my heart, I knew that people would help me. So, and this woman come along, and she stood in front of me. There's 20 people in front of this bus queue, and I'm sat there outside the place, and I just thought, oh, you know, I really didn't know what to do. I didn't have enough for a meal left. I had nothing. And she come over and she said to me, she had a problem with her voice, but I had enough about me to realise what she was trying to say. She was asking me for money, for food. And I said, I'm really sorry, I've got nothing. I haven't got nothing. And I went in my pocket. A Singaporean dollar is about 50 pence. And I went in my pocket and I found this $1. And I looked and I said, I tell you what, this is it. This is all I've got. You're quite welcome to it. I don't know, Nick. To me, it was my test. But the bus come and I give it her. She smiled at me. And I said, I'm sorry, if I had more, I'd give it you. And the bus come, and they all have these Oyster cards like they do in London. So they don't pay, they scan the card. And the bus driver's looking, and she walked past everybody. The bus driver didn't even look at her or stop her or... I can't explain it. I really can't. And she walked past everyone. She went and sat at the back of the bus. No one looked at her. No one talked to her. When the bus sat off, just smiled at me and waved at me. I thought that was a bit weird, and I thought nothing of it. And then the day after, I got my visa for 6 months. I managed to get back to Bali. I managed to just about have enough petrol in the motorbike to get me to where the very north of the island, which was, I think it would have been, might have been 30 pence, I think, to fill the scooter, 125 scooter. I think I just had enough to fill the motorbike up. And I drove for 4 hours, and I got myself back, and everybody were there, and I didn't have to. It was like, listen, I'm here, I've got no money, I'm going to carry this on. And people said to me, don't worry about it. Because food today, you know, you're talking about 20 pence a meal. You're not talking a lot. Compared, you know, I just said, look, I'm here, and, you know, I've been helping, this is what I'm doing, and I need help. And they all looked after me, every single one of them. And that was when the house come in, and they give me a motorbike, and they give me food. And I didn't really have to worry for it. I paid for the food eventually, after the month, but they give me a bill for a month. I think a month's bill for food cost me £50-60 for the month. Mm-hmm. So it was just so surreal how it all happened.
As a kind of by-the-by, how did you get on with the food over there? Because last I saw of you, you didn't eat vegetables, and it's pretty much a vegetarian society, isn't it, over there?
I never ate vegetables at all. but actually, you know, I'm 2 years ago, I never ate a vegetable in my life. I eat vegetables every day now, Nick. Yeah, but let me get back to this because I totally forgot about it. But when I went to Bali, I knew what I wanted to do, and I told one of my friends there that what I was going to do, and he mentioned an orphanage to me. And so I had all these intentions, and there was very positive intentions. So what I did was, and when I set off, the doctor gave me the ticket, and I never took any clothes, and I never took anything for myself. What I did do was I went to see my friend who's been helping in an orphanage, Christian Elmo Elm, his name is on Facebook, and he said to me, you know, will you go to an orphanage for me? He said, I've been helping there for a while as a volunteer. So I said, of course I will. You know, we've both got these same thoughts, same ideas. I think he did a couple of weeks there. So what I did was I never took any clothes for myself. I took a full suitcase of football strips, which were they were second-hand, donated by a local team in Burnley. And he said to me, will you take these? So I never took any clothes, took them all over. The first day as soon as I landed, somebody sent somebody to come and meet me. And he said, where do you want to go? I said, I need to go to an orphanage. And I went there, and that was the start of it for me. That was really the beginning, because going to these places and, you know, these parts of Bali, if you go to Ubud and things like that, they're the rich parts. And they have these schools, and they call them green school. Yet, why is it green? Only the rich kids can go. So for me, my friend asked me to go to this place, and it was really poor. And he had already been involved in a project. He went back home, and he helped raise with events £15,000 to put a new roof on the orphanage. So he said to me, please, can you go here, and will you drop these? And it was the best thing I ever did. And I thought, if this is the start of things to come, I hope this just keeps going and going and going and going. And it really meant, just for that first day, it kick-started the reason why I was there. And it made so much of a difference. So, you know, I've got to say a big thank you to Christian, because I knew what I wanted to do. We spoke about it before, Nick, that my intentions were what I wanted to do, and the talks I've done at Truth Juice and things like that. But I went there with... I didn't have a plan. I don't make plans. I live off instinct. if you make plans, plans go wrong. I've always said, you know, someone else said to me once, you know, if you want to make God laugh, tell him your plan. Because at any time of day, he can change them. You know, you might be going somewhere, but there could be a car crash. So your plan's been changed. You don't know. You've no idea what's going to happen for the future. So that day that I did that, it changed my life for me. And I've got to say, Christian, thank you very much. You changed my life.
So you kind of moved on from the teaching then?
Yeah, it was
Is any of it still running, or did it kind of go away with you, really?
Well, no. What happened was, I was on a social visa. I got my second social visa, which meant that I stayed for a year.
So you can't actually teach on a social, I guess, even if they weren't paying you. Is that the...
That's correct. You still need a working visa. And
great.
So what happened, I'm terrible, mind, but for the second time, I was late for the immigration to get my visa extended. Because once you've got the six-month visa, you still have to go every month and get a monthly extension. I was just so busy in what I was doing that I literally forgot. And I'd been reminded a week before, but I still forgot. So anyway, they thought I was actually working there, earning money, and he said to me, will you write us a written statement and tell us what you've been doing? I said, of course I will. So I wrote a full written, yes, I've set up school here. So I didn't lie. I told them exactly what I'd do. I did. I give them the priest number. I give them the head of the school number, the head of the village number. Contact these people. They will tell you. I said, I have no intention. I said, maximum wage here is £60 a month. I said, I have no intention of working here. I said, I might as well go on. I said, my intentions are to give something back to your community. So I didn't lie about it. And the immigration officers who interviewed me, they didn't have the final say. It was a new immigration officer who said, sorry, rules are rules. You know, you're going to have to go or pay a stupid, ridiculous £15,000 fine. That's corruption for you. And these guys said to me, look, you know, we really like what you've been doing. Normally, we'd lock you up in a cell, you get a ticket back home, and we'd extradite you, and you'd never be able to come back. But we like what you've been doing. So what we're going to do is give you 3 days to sort yourself out. Go and get your ticket, wherever you want to go, and we'll meet you at the airport, which was 4 hours away. They didn't escort me. It was really nice for me. I can't fault the guy. And they said to me, you know, once you're allowed to come back, when you come back, get the same visa, the social visa, but before you do anything, come and see us, and we will give you the documents and the paperwork to make sure that you can do whatever you like here. So as you're not working for money.
So the corruption kind of does cut both ways. I mean, it must have been heartbreaking for that to occur, but I suppose you got the dispensation and they did say you could go back.
Exactly. They said to me, it's up to you. I said, well, I'm not going back to England. I don't want to go back to England. They said, well, we'll give you 3 days to sort yourself. Like, realistically, I should have been shoved on a plane, should have been locked up in a cell. But they didn't. So I can't fault them for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I rang up my cousin, who was also, he's my best friend, who lives in Thailand, he's a teacher. I said, look, you know, I'm being deported. I don't want to go to England. And he said, get yourself here, get yourself sorted, you're okay, you can come and stay at my house. My friend who was teaching with me in Bali, who's from Spain, he's like my brother. The guy is amazing, Victor. Big thank you to you. Big shout to you. Love you to bits. He said to me, I'll give you the money to pay for your flight. Because obviously, like I said, you know, I hadn't earned any money. I'd had a little bit to live, and that was it. So he said, I'll pay for your ticket. Get yourself to Bali. Get yourself sorted. 6 months, you could be back. So he sorted that out. I came here, and tell you what, Nick, you've never seen anybody so depressed, so unhappy, to have to go to Thailand to live.
Well, when you think about how well it had gone for you there and how useful you were being and how, you know, not just the locals, but people from around the world were coming and tapping you on the back as well, it must have been hell of a wrench, really. Especially because, effectively, it was because you'd forgotten to go and get a piece of sodding paper.
Yeah, honestly, Nick, my friend said to me, I must have been depressed for the first month, maybe 6 weeks, maybe 2 months. I didn't go anywhere. locked myself in a house, just sat on a computer, thinking about what am I going to do. And I really didn't know. But I didn't know how I was going to live, even, you know. I was, and luckily, I got a four-month contract. I could have gone and looked for a job in a private school. I didn't want to teach private children. I didn't want to go down that lane where I'm teaching spoiled little brats, basically, that had everything they needed. Even in Thailand, they spoiled people, you know what I mean? There's still rich people here that are separated from the other part of the community.
I think there's rich people everywhere, isn't there? I know that Bali's a bit of a holiday island, isn't it?
Well, they call it the land of the gods. And, yeah, I chose there because it's so segregated. And for the other work that I was doing with protection of children, there was things that were going on that I was helping with. And, yeah, let's just say one person is now doing a lot of time in prison. Mm.
I'll tell you what, Tony, can we have a quick 10-minute break? There you go. So that is time. We haven't got time for a 10-minute break because we've still got plenty of stuff to come. We've got to hear Tony's stories in Thailand, and Christian's going to be talking to us a bit about just exactly what's going on in the Philippines, which is where Tony's going next. So there's not a lot of time for a 10-minute break, but we have got time for just a quick 2-minute and 40-second tune, so you can all go and do whatever it is you need to do, and then it'll be back to Tony. There you go, bit of the Who there, nice old tune, and anyway, anyhow, anywhere I choose. And now, straight back to Tony, who's now in Thailand. Anyway, there.
So here we are back again. We've managed to sort out all the bits and bobs that needed sorted, and I've still got Tony on the line. And we got as far as getting you to Thailand. Well, before we go into what you did when you finally came out of your room there, what were your favourite personal things about Bali, apart from, you know, all the excellent work you did out there?
Well, let me tell you a little bit about Bali. Something that you don't see anywhere else in the world. There was no street cameras. There's no motorways, but there's major roads, but no street cameras. You don't have surveillance at every place you go to. Yet I'll tell you something else. There's no trouble. You don't need the cameras. Everybody's so nice. All right, it takes you back you could be living 100 years before, you know, some of these houses are huts, so to speak. It's very poor, but like I said, there is no cameras. You're not under 24-hour surveillance.
And that must have been a relief in itself, wasn't it? I mean, there must have been loads of good things about leaving this jurisdiction for that one, but no cameras, that'd be great.
Well, one of the first things you notice is when you're back home, everywhere you go, you always find yourself looking to see where the cameras are. It doesn't matter. You've got them on the motorways, you've got them on the side streets. It doesn't matter. They're everywhere. And when you're there, it's like you're looking for them, but they're not there. And it takes a bit of getting used to. It really does. Because you're not under that, you know, the control. All right, this corruption, like I said earlier, but it's corruption that you see in front of your face. So you get stopped off the police. They're on very little wages, so you've got to understand it. It's like, you know, they're the lowest paid. So it's same with Thailand. They're not on a lot of money, so there is a little corruption. So you get stopped with no helmet. You pay. In England, the corruption's there, but the police don't get the money. It goes to the government. Where in these places, it's what they do to make their living. So you might get charged a couple of pounds for no helmet. You might get charged £4 for no licence. I got stopped, me, and I was with a girl. We were going to a hot spring. So it's a beautiful country. You've got waterfalls, hot springs, you can go out in the morning from 6 o'clock and watch dolphins in the wild in natural habitat. It really is something special. And, you know, it's we got stopped off the police, and, you know, I started giving it, I don't have a name, Bob. And I thought, I can't be doing this. And she's, and why are you stopping me? What are you doing this for? And she's going, shut up. Just give him your passport. Just, it doesn't matter. And I'm like, I'd love to argue with him. I really would. But the fact is, I'd rather do it back home than I would back there.
Yeah.
Definitely. Because they don't mess about with you. They lock you up and probably get beat up or something. But, well, you would back home. But the chances are I could be in prison for 2 years before it went to court.
Right.
So you don't try none of that stuff. It's, you know, you go with the system. She's going, shut up. Just give him your details. Sign the document. Sign it. You go to court because I refuse to pay. And when I went to court, the judge was on holiday. So they just fined me anyway, made me pay something like £4 for having no licence or whatever it was. I have a driving licence, I've been driving, but it's not one of their licences.
Right.
But yeah, there was some amazing things. Like I said, there's a hot spring, which natural, waterfalls that are 4 or 5 tiers, so you know, amazing natural beauty. But one of the funniest things that happened to me was I spent my 40th birthday out there. And some of the guys invited me and said, come on, you can have a drink with us. And out there, it's totally different. It doesn't matter if you don't have any money. It's like everybody shares. Everything goes on the table. And from where I'm from, Burnley, that's how we are. And I've never seen many places like that in the UK that are like that. It's like, if you've got it, you can have it. And when I went to Bali, it was like, and I said, no, you're all right. I didn't have any money. It was like, you know, I've got a... Hey, oh, yeah, brilliant. Christians online. So it was like, you know, I don't know what to do. And said, no, it doesn't matter. So everybody's equal. Everybody's equal. You know, the ones who are basically, live normal lives, they're not the rich elite people, everybody shares. So on my birthday, these guys invited me for my birthday to come and have a drink with them, and they got the beers in, and you know, and the funny thing about it all is I was drinking with these three guys, and I just thought, if I tell everybody, nobody would believe me. But the names were, one was called Bang Bang, one was called Go Bang and one was called Bonking. Now, you couldn't make it up. And I swear down, these people actually became very, very, very close friends of mine. And, yeah, it's a special place. If you could be a woman, you could be walking the street at 3 o'clock in the morning, you wouldn't get, they'd pull up and say, would you like a lift home? Do you need this? Or where are you going? I can't explain how friendly and how totally different to anywhere in the world I have ever been in my life. And, you know, that's why I was upset about it. It became my home. I love the place. It's just so special. It's like, I cannot explain it. And you know something, these people have got nothing. And you're watching children that are sat there, will play with... go back to when you were a kid. When I was a kid, we used to play Green Tin Tin. It was a ball in the middle of the street. You kicked it and you all went, like kind of hide and seek, British Bulldog, all these things. And yet everybody was happy. And, you know, it took me back to my youth where people... people just like had nothing, but everybody had such a smile on the face. It was like, I can't explain to you. It was like, it took me back to my youth, not my youth, my childhood. So when I was 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and you're watching, you're seeing kids there that they come to the house and the parents would bring them and they'd sit there and they'd play with a couple of stones on the floor, a bit like hopscotch, but something different. And they didn't come over going, I'm bored. They actually had a smile on their face.
I think there's definitely a way in which the kind of, the the apparent wealth and distraction of things and stuff has moved us away from all of that. It is it's my hope that as things fall away from us, we might find our way back to that. Because it struck me when I was up in Blackpool talking to the people up at New Horizons. All of the people on the streets that we met were really friendly. They really wanted to talk to you and stuff. Your keyboard's coming across pretty loud on the recording, I reckon.
Yeah. It does, honestly, Nick. You know, like I said earlier, you know, when I had a lump in my throat for the child in England that was smiling for a meal, it just, you know, the house that I stayed in, I used a bucket with a pan, plastic pan, which was my shower. I had a hole in the floor that was my toilet. You know, and I lived basic. I lived exactly as they did, but I had to live like that.
Do you reckon you could leave the keyboard alone for a bit, because it's probably going to be a bit distracting for people?
Yeah, sorry, Nick.
That's all right.
Okay. Well, there's Christian's online as well now, so we've got Christian. I think we've got Nathan that are going to come online, so you can have a chat with them as well.
Brilliant.
I just said to him about 30 minutes.
Great.
So I'll leave the keyboard now it's finished.
Thank you very much.
No problem. Yeah, so it really does take you back, and it makes you realise that, it's, you know, this was what I wanted to do. It's not money that makes... It wasn't money that made... You know, it's interaction. Where's it gone? What's happened to community spirit in our country? You know, and, yeah, it's fantastic to look at how these people live. You don't sit there crying. Well, these kids don't cry. They're so happy. They're so indulged in life. They're happy with a pen and paper and drawing. And, you know, they don't have no toys. They don't have games. So it takes you back and it makes you think. And it really does make you realise how lucky we really are.
Yeah. Yeah. So what happened in Thailand then? You spent 5 or 6 years, and we can see now why it is that you were so upset to leave. But what happened in your time in Thailand?
Well, I landed here, and my friend said, I can get you a job. So I worked in a government school. It was really funny because they'd never seen anybody teach like me before. In fact, the teachers were coming to the classroom, sticking their head round the door, wanting to know why the kids were shouting. When they looked, they were like, they just left me alone. And one of the teachers came afterwards and said to me, they said, we love teaching our class straight after you've had your class. He said, because normally the kids come to class and want to fall asleep. But when they come after your class, they've got so much energy that it's a pleasure to teach them. And I said, well, you know, it's not this. If you give the children a chance, and this is the thing about education that I keep saying all over and over and over again. Education in the UK is not about education and self-development. It's about programming. This is why the ones who don't absorb the programming get left behind. So, you know, if you aren't part of that system, your clusters, what they used to call, I don't know what they call it now, a dunce. Yet you might have a magnificent set of hands that you can, you know, you might be an artist, you might be able to fix. Why aren't they giving these children something else that can help their creativity? Which to me is what education is about. It's about developing the person to who you are, what you want to do. Not education to carry on the system, to work within the boundaries, what they call as normal. So, yeah, when I came out to Thailand, it was like, that's what I did. I went and taught for 4 months, and I didn't want to do that permanently. It wasn't what I came here to do. So basically, I've had 4 months working in 2 years. So the contract finished, and I never renewed the contract. You know, I wanted to. This is what I came out here for. I came out here to help people. So what happened next was I ended up in hospital, basically, for I had an abscess on my throat, and I didn't have the money to go to a private hospital. I wasn't insured. So I went to government hospital, and I was there for nearly a week, and I was really ill. I couldn't breathe, I couldn't swallow, and I was using sign language, if you want to call it that, gestures, to be able to communicate, because I couldn't talk. And they couldn't speak English anyway. So what happened was there's some people here that had heard about the projects I've been doing, and they came and they asked me if I would start teaching their son, which I agreed to. And they said in return, they're building a new shopping complex. They said to me, what they said to me was, you help us, and we will help in the next year, once our shopping complex has been built, we will help sponsor your projects. So I thought, fantastic. Anyway, I was in hospital. They came to see me, and they basically told me to pack my things. They took me to, it was a private hospital. And they took me to see this doctor that they knew personally. And within 30 minutes, he'd got a scalpel, cut the thing out while I was awake, and then sent me to a hospital just to stay there a night. But the cost of the price, it was like a 7-star hotel. I only stayed there a night. It cost £400. But even the government hospital, they covered all the costs for me. I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe how nice they were to me. And they said to me, look, anything that you need, this shopping complex is going to be there in a year. You help us. We will help you with future projects. We can't promise the world until everything's done. We're just getting, the construction's being done, basically. But we are local people. We are from the area. And we're not a corporation that's come from out of the area where the money where we employ, we're going to employ local people. The money's going to stay within the local area. What we'd like to know is if you're going to do a project in this area, that we can be involved and that you're going to do a project within Thailand. So I totally agreed with that. I thought, brilliant. It was amazing that people were hearing about what I've been trying to do. And because for 12 months, you do it yourself and, you put everything you've got into it, not just every little bit of money that you've got spare, but your energy. Your energy is the biggest, your energy and your time is what you're giving. It is really hard work. And for them to come and do that for me, I was, wow, I can't say how much I thanked them for it. So after they did that for me, I thought to myself, right, what else can you do here? You don't just go to a place and say I want to set up a school. The thing for me is protection of children. If I said to people that came to Bali that everyone could go and do a class, go and do that, go and do this, then I'm not taking the children into consideration. Now, to get back to it, you asked me if the projects were still going just before we had a break. They're not anymore, but they were for quite a while. Now, Victor was part of the project, who was basically like my brother from Spain. Him and one of the local girls, they carried on the project in the areas that started until the project had finished, basically, until what I'd set up had come to an end and they'd managed to pass their exams and do everything I wanted. But the people in the villages, and totally understandable, because you've got to understand that there is no checks on the people. No, the people that said that I could do it were people that knew me from before, people that knew the kind of person I were, and the fact that I also invited the parents and other people, adults, the priest, head of the village. There was always somebody around. I never taught on my own. There was always somebody there. It made it a lot different. It made it so that it was possible for me to do what I wanted to do. And the one thing that I didn't like what I saw was people going there from around the world with no CBR checks, no checks whatsoever. And the fact that, you know, they were setting up, this really, really annoyed me, that there was getting help from their own government, and they were sponsoring them. They was giving them the money to go and do this, and they'd set up for maybe a few months, and it'd be a free school. They'd have the money to build it. They'd have a nice place. But after they'd done that, then they started charging for these schools. And also, how come all of a sudden they have this big, nice villa that pops up from nowhere? The children aren't getting the money that's been put into that place for them to get an education. They're giving a little bit, but they're not giving what has been sent over. They're looking after number one. So I always said to the people there, I said, look, I'm not here to buy land. I am not here to build an house. I am here to help you. You know, they trusted me, so that made a lot of difference. So when I actually had to leave, they appreciated and they let the girl, who was a local girl, she was Balinese, and Victor, they let them finish the project. But they did turn around and say after that, which was a compliment on my part, he said, please don't have anybody else come unless you're present. We will wait for you to come back to Bali, and when it all gets set up again, then once it's all running, then we're quite happy for other people to come and continue the way that you was doing it before. But for me to just invite people that I didn't know would be wrong on my part, and, you know, wrong on their part for accepting it. So it goes both ways. They've learned, because talking to some of the people out there, I don't really want to go into much details because you never know who's going to listen. Mm-hmm. But the laws out there make it very easy for people to basically do whatever they like.
Yeah.
And the way I was explaining things to people, hopefully within the next few years, they're going to change the law on how people come, not only communicate, but become part of the communities and interact, especially with children. Because out here, in places like this, money talks and it stinks. I'm sure you understand what I'm saying. You know, we've all heard about people like Paul Gadd. What was his name? Paul Gadd was, wanna be in my gang, what was his name?
Oh, Gary Glitter.
Gary Glitter, we all know. They get done and yet they just pay themselves out of it and they're gone. So I am trying to help change the law in how people come out to these places. People like Madonna, I don't care, she might be a nice person. But actually, there should be laws put in place. Who comes and actually, sponsorship, fair enough. But sponsorship, this still should be under supervision order, whether it's from the head of the village or the priests, or it shouldn't be just lying to take these kids and go off and do whatever they are. So when I try to explain to them, you know, about who controls all this, they've actually started thinking about it. And hopefully when I go back, we'll should be around about May, then we can start putting something into place, put it towards government, where we get these situations. Yes. This is what I mean about law. I'm not against law. You know, I don't want the English law to go back to exactly what's happening in these countries and people taking advantage. And if people start to learn about what is, it goes both ways, Nick. And this is what I was saying at the beginning. I've had to look at both sides of the coin. You know, so it's difficult. difficult. It really is difficult.
So in a way, that's the kind of extension of the sort of stuff you were doing here, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But for me, it's like, I could be a keyboard warrior, sit there and...
Hang on, you're breaking up for the first time in the call there.
Right. I could be a keyboard warrior, or I could go and visit these places.
Well, just fancy that, eh, folks? Me and Tony had been talking for the best part of 3 hours by then with just one little glitch back at the beginning. As soon as he mentions Paul Gadd and Madonna in connection with Thailand and these countries, look what happens. Isn't that an amazing coincidence? It took less than 60 seconds for the Skype call to collapse more or less entirely. Like I say, what a coincidence, eh? Luckily, all the clicking on the keyboard and stuff had been Tony rounding up Christian, because the next place Tony wants to go to is the Philippines, and Christian, you heard him put a big shout-out to Christian earlier on. We had continued problems with Tony's Skype connection after that. He did manage to come back to us at the end, but luckily for me, like I say, he'd managed to round up Christian, so we had a chat with him about the Philippines instead, which is what we're going to hear next. But before we do that, Christian's put a message into the Skype chat box for me here. They're basically planning on going over there and doing, you know, direct aid, really. Individual people using their own resources to go out and help people who are less well off than themselves. And in the Philippines, as we're going to hear, they are having one hell of a time. Christian told me about 10:30 this evening. I'll read this, just read this little bit out before we listen to what he had to say when I spoke to him last Sunday. They're basically having a shipping container moved over there with a whole load of goods and tools and that kind of stuff in it. And Christian told me on the Skype, he said, I got an update from the Philippines today. The Bureau of Customs is not anymore allowing us to manually process the customs clearing of the donated shipment. We can only do such if we have clearance from the Department of Social Welfare and Development. But unfortunately, we can't avail such clearance because Rotary Club of Cebu West Gift of Life Foundation is not accredited yet and doesn't have the license to operate. So we have to find another association that will maybe accept the goods so we can distribute. He says it's an absolute joke. It's like they don't want us to help. So that's what's going on at the moment. They're all ready to go. Literally Sunday, they've got the shipping container over there. It's full of stuff that they've managed to get together. And they're going out there on Sunday to start handing it out and helping people out and stuff. And suddenly somebody's coming and brought a hammer down on it. Absolutely disgusting. I'll put Christian's kindly volunteered to let us put his email address in the chat box. I'll read it out a bit later, because if anybody has a bit of extra resource or feels like helping out in any way, then Christian's the man to get in touch with. But in the meantime, I'll now play the bit of the conversation that I had with Christian at the end of the conversation that I was having with Tony. That, like I say, Tony's Skype connection remained a little bit dodgy. I had a really nice chat with Christian. I've not met the man before, and we got on sort of straight away, but unfortunately dickhead DJ forgot to press the record button on the bloody Skype player, so I missed the first 15 minutes, which meant I had to kind of retrace my steps a bit. So my apologies to Christian for that, and to Tony. It was very unprofessional, but being as I'm not being paid, I'm an amateur, so I suppose we can all forgive me for that. But nonetheless, I think we had a pretty good conversation. So the next bit of it is me chatting with Christian about his next move and Tony's next move, which is to go and help out in a place which it sounds to me like it's been absolutely flattened. So here it is, Dr. Rock talking last Sunday with Christian, and a bit with Tony as well.
Christian, Elmo, tell him about, tell them about the football strips, because I told them already that was how I got involved with it. And, I'm telling you, you got me started with all this shit and wanting to do something different. And I really thank you for that. I already put a shout out to you, which will go out earlier on in the show before you've been dragged in. I'm glad it's not midweek, because it's going to go out midweek. So I'm glad you're not working. I'm glad you've been able to get here. That was fantastic. I can't believe you didn't record that, Nick.
Well, we'll just...
You know what, really good today, am.
That was well good.
Well, we'll just have to give it a note. Thanks a lot for joining us, Christian. And sorry I cocked up there. We'll give it another run. So you met up. You've known each other for a long time, you and Tony. And you, what were you doing in Bali when you met up with him there?
No, we didn't meet up in Bali. Tony went over to Bali after I'd been there, and I sent him over with two football kits for this orphanage. Because we used to go out playing football with the children, and we got some socks and football boots donated, but they had no football kits. So I sent our aunt there, come round to my parents' house, give them two football kits, and he took them out there for the kids. Yeah, and then sent me, logged it up and sent me some pictures on me. Yeah, they loved them.
And you were responsible for rescuing an orphanage. You were saying that the government was planning on closing.
Yeah, the government was going to close it down. They wanted X amount of pounds. Otherwise, they were going to close it down and throw all the kids and everybody in it out on the streets. It does sound unbelievable, but that's what they would have done. They don't seem to have the humanitarian issues over that we have over here. Yeah.
And so, one of the reasons Tony thought I should call you in was because you've got a bit more experience of the Philippines than he has. Have you been you've been there a lot?
Yeah, I was there near almost a year. We went round working with, I call them street families, people living on streets, families living on streets, living in graveyards. We go around to different slums, we do dental missions, medical missions, school supplies, feeding projects, clothing projects, you know, giving them fresh new clothes. We get dentists in from Denmark, and we go around and dentistry in the Philippines is a major issue. People just can't afford to go to dentists, can't afford it. So it's where we used to come in. They can't afford to go to doctors, they can't afford clean water, good food, so we used to give them clean food, clean sanitarium products, you know, things like that.
That's a major variety of work for you to be doing. Are you working with other people?
Yeah, I mean, I loved it though. It was fantastic. I mean, the Filipino people are just amazing. Just amazing. They just can't do enough for you. They can't, you know, they're so resilient to the people, and they never seem to get down about anything. You know, I mean, when I was there in November, I spoke to a family in Tacloban, where the hardest hit area was. And they lost six of their seven children in the typhoon. And he's telling me this, and he's like, and the guy's there, the father, he's saying that he can't find his two-year-old and his four-year-old body. And I'm crying. I'm crying, talking to him. And he's grabbing hold of me. And he's hugging me, and he's saying, don't cry. Why are you upset? God chose this way for my children. We are lucky. We're young. We can start another family. I'm like, how do you keep it together? How do you cope?
That's amazing, isn't it, when you think of the attitudes in this country?
Yeah. They have so much faith, though. It's like they believe everything happens for a reason. You know, and if something like that happened here, like the storms have been happening in England, you know, down south. The government's not doing enough, the government's not doing this, the government's not doing that, the army should have been involved beforehand, and insurance, blah, blah, blah. Whereas over there, it's just, you get on with it, and you rebuild your house, and you rebuild your farm, your chicken farm, your mango farm, your coconut farm, whatever you've got, you rebuild it without any help, either help from your neighbours or any help from government, especially. You know, you can just do it yourself.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned insurance there. Maybe that, because it's occurred to me that that's one of the things that allows people to lose things and believe they can get them back again without any effort on their own part. And without insurance, perhaps we'd have to be a bit more resilient.
Yeah, well, they don't have insurance over there. Even car insurance is, I think it's like £11 a year. And you don't get, you just, it's paid for by the government, but it doesn't work. That's one thing the government, I think you pay it and it's a government run scheme, but it doesn't work. Someone crashes into you, you just, no, you don't buy a nice car in the Philippines because it just doesn't work out like that. As long as you have insurance, that's all that matters.
It sounds like insurance is another government scam then, just another tax, really.
Yeah, it is a very corrupt country, which is a shame. You do get, I mean, I've got some politicians out there who did want trying to turn things around, but it doesn't help because then you'll get other politicians who will go against certain politicians for doing this. So you're just fighting a losing battle. You're just banging your head against a brick wall. You're not going to win. Everybody's in it for the money. Same with all the aid that's been donated throughout every single country. Like I say, there's over £700 million worth of aid. Where is it all? I mean, you can see where some of it is, but
it's an astonishing amount of money. It sounds like things were pretty bad there before the typhoon hit. And it's, what sort of effect did, because you've been there since the typhoon hit, what sort of things did you see when you got there?
Well, I mean, when we went to Tacloban, we obviously had to get there by boat because the airport was just wiped out. There was a mall there, the SM Mall, which was about the size of Trafford Centre, just wiped to the floor. It was just unbelievable. Such a thing as a typhoon could do this to massive infrastructures of this magnitude. And it was just the roads, it was just, every road was just strewn with trees, but parts of infrastructure. It was just wreckage everywhere, absolutely everywhere. And obviously, it was still flooded in a big way, and there was still bodies getting pulled out from everywhere. It was really, really tragic. Horrible.
So what are you hoping to do when you get back out, there in May? Tony said you're going over, or no, before May, isn't it? It's in 10 days or so.
Yeah, we're going in about, I'll be in 2 weeks. I should be out there. There's a container I've just sent out there full of humanitarian aid, relief aid, full of sanitary products, toys, food, sweets, a lot of toys because obviously there's no schools for the kids in Tacloban. So the kids have nothing to do now in the daytime. So we've got a lot of sanitary products, a lot of tools, rice, things like that. We're just going to buy rice, more tools. We're just going to get them back up and running again, get them back started again, get them rebuilding. Through what they've got there, through buildings that have been obviously flattened to the ground. It's obvious, I mean, the equipment's there, you just have to pull it out, sew it up, nail it in, and start again. And that's what they are as a people. They will do that. We just want to help them out by doing that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're obviously going out there as, I guess, what might be described as an independent charity, aren't you? How do you find the other charities respond to your presence?
The Red Cross for a start. They do the part, but they obviously get paid. When we was going up into the mountains to feed families in villages there, that no one would go near because they said, "Oh, we can't get up." They say we can't get up. I said, "Well, who's going to feed these families?" But we're feeding families on the ground down here. But what about the families in the villages that are up in the mountains? So we were going up there. We hired a truck. We were going up there. All right, fair enough. There were logs, trees all at the road, and we'd have to get out and move them. But yeah, they didn't seem interested in things like that. And They didn't seem too interested in us being there because we wasn't a registered charity. They said we hadn't, because we wasn't registered, we didn't have a right to be there, really, which was very, very, very annoying.
Yeah, I can imagine that. It seems to me that that it's being made more and more a fact that if you want to be a charity, you've got to be registered. And we know that registration is the handing over of superior rights of guardianship and title, so presumably that's a way of the government getting money instead of giving it to the people, is it?
Well, exactly. It's another tax that you've got to pay, isn't it, through donations, things like that. But why can't people just want to go out there and just pay their own way and do what they want and without having to register, you know? All right, yeah, there are scammers out there and things like that, but you know, people like me, I don't ask for anything off anybody. I'll go out there and pay for everything, so I'm not scamming nothing. And yet, you just don't think the Red Cross and the UNICEF don't seem to appreciate this. They turn me, I asked Red Cross to help me out from a container because I needed a charity to vouch for my container so I wouldn't have to pay customs tax. And I got the Rotary Institute to do that for me. Because I could be importing anything to that country. I could be importing drugs, anything. Because I'm not a registered charity, they don't know, so they'd have to go through each box that I've sent. But if I had a charity to vouch for me, then which we have now, but Red Cross turned me down. No thanks, not interested.
So yeah. they sort of have... I mean, in a way, you'd have thought they had a kind of responsibility to help the people who are trying to help, especially being as they get so much money, you know, to help.
Well, they do, but the thing is, the Red Cross, it's a business. They get paid, every one of them get paid. So a lot of them are doing it, not because they want to help, they're doing it because it's a job, you know, which, okay, it's a good job. But, you know, you've got to think to yourself, would they go that extra mile if they wasn't getting paid? Or if it was just minimal pay, you know? I don't know. Would they go the extra mile? I don't think so.
No, I mean, it strikes me there's a big difference between those people and the kind of activities that Tony's been describing and your attitude. I mean, your main aim is to help. It's not going out there as a job to earn money for yourself or to fill the time or whatever. And I don't know, I guess that sort of help must be so much more committed. Like you say, you're going up into the mountains and doing all the work necessary to get there. You can see that they don't seem to be going the extra mile.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to help, and that's all we want to do. We're going to help. Don't want anything for it. We don't want, just want, you know, we just want to go out there and get these people back from the gutter and back up and running again. Just, you know, and every little helps, every little bit helps, and just, you know, get them a bit of shelter, get them a bit of fresh food, give them some clean clothing, clean shoes, you know, get the kids, give the kids something to do, something to play, some colouring books, things like that. And it makes them happy. And, you know, it gives them a sense of well-being, a sense of work. And it's great when you see that they'll see Western people coming over, helping them, giving them things. And we don't have to. We don't have to do it. And they appreciate it so much. It's amazing. Like Anthony will tell you, it's just amazing when you're helping them out, and they just can't thank you enough. It's just unbelievable.
Must be the best reward that you can get, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, it's just so uplifting to see. When you're giving things out, sacks of rice and food and tinsels and stuff like that, and thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. And thank you, thank you, and thank you, thank you. It's okay. It's okay. No problem. Thank you. And it's never like, oh, I want more. Or can I have some more? Or can I have this? Can I have a sap? You know, you'll just give them a bag of rice, a couple of bags of noodles, some fresh water, Do you need, you know, do you need anything else? Some vitamins for the children, some sweets for children, you know, nothing much. It's only like maybe £10 worth of goods for, you know, and that's it. And it's nothing to us, but to them, so much of them just thank you. All right. Relentless in thanking you. It's amazing. Amazing.
And Tony was telling us that he accidentally and absentmindedly fell foul of the visa system in Bali, which led to him having to remove himself to Thailand. What's it like in the Philippines for paperwork?
Yeah, well, Philippines is again, it's annoying. You get 3 weeks visa when you get there, and after 3 weeks, you've just got to keep renewing it. It's not a lot. I think it's £27, but when you live there. And you're just living off your savings. It's £27 every 3 weeks. And you've got to go down. You can't just do it online or anything like that. You've got to go down to the place, to the immigration, sign it, pay for it, go back. You know, it's an annoyance. It's
every 3 weeks. That's really, I find that really shocking.
They could round up to a month, couldn't they?
Well, at least, yeah. You can almost imagine that it was once 6 months and then they took it to 3 and then took it to 4 weeks and down to 3 weeks. No. But
can I say, on the asshole bank's paper, we paper ourselves. Christian said earlier, you know, we're funding ourselves. It's not the fact that we've got to pay for it. It's the hassle of having to go and do it, which is miles away. And you might have to leave the country sometimes. It's the whole system, the way it works. Mm. Not the pay for it.
Yeah, sometimes to leave the country and then go back in, just cross the border and go back in. I mean, why?
And it must be a major distraction from what you're trying to do. I mean, quite a lot of your effort must be taken into doing that sort of thing.
Yeah, and you're thinking, we're here to help your people. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help your people, and you're charging us money to do that. You're not giving us like, oh, hang on a minute. Yeah, he's here to do that. Let's give him some grace and let him. But no, you don't get that. Whereas here in this country, anybody can come in and just claim anything they want, can't they? So
it does certainly seem that way sometimes.
Yeah, it does. They've got it. They seem to have. They just don't seem to want. Well. The government doesn't seem to want it. The people want it, but the government doesn't seem to want to even help. You know what I mean? It's just very, it is corruption at its highest level.
Governments, it seems to me, are just not helpful, are they? Really, they're just expensive, and they're, you know, if they were doing their job properly, they'd be out helping the people whose, you know, entire city had been flattened around them.
Yeah. I mean, when I was there, the Philippine army was helping, but you had the French army as well, you had the Norwegian army, the English, British army, the Americans. But yeah, if they did the job properly, like you say, they wouldn't be in this mess in the first place. Well, they wouldn't be, I'm sure they could sort it out better. I mean, like I say, £100 million, hell of a lot of money. And it's going somewhere.
And not to the people, by the sound of it.
Well, not exactly. Not it'll be doing its rounds first with the politicians and councillors, I'm sure, before it goes directly to the people. Because you can buy relief goods out there, rice, things like that. For that, it's so cheap. So cheap. I mean, and that's all they live off. A lot of Filipinos, rice. But, you know, just imagine. Even with £1 million of rice, you could probably feed the whole of Philippines for a year. I don't know. Just to get, but, it's just, where is it going? So frustrating.
Well, it does seem that nearly all activity is run by corporations, and so the money goes to them rather than to, you know, I guess the people there, like the people here, are treated pretty much like livestock.
Yeah, they are. It's they don't get much help off. It's a funny system in the Philippines. It's like, you know, the judicial system as well. If you get arrested, you're guilty. It's not like here, you're guilty until proven innocent. over there. So it's like, they'll just throw you in jail, and it's very, you know, people are always getting arrested for something they haven't done. They don't have DNA or anything, something like that. They don't have CCTV or anything like that. So it's just a case of easily making from that. And yeah, it's very, in this day and age, it's very, prehistoric.
Yeah. Are there many other kind of, independent individuals like yourself out there?
Yeah, there's a guy called Will. He's from Southampton. He's a good guy. I'm meeting him back out there. There's a lot of Filipinos who get involved as well, who are, not to say well off, but you know, who are doing all right, who are more than willing to help other people, their own people, like, more than willing. I got put up by a family when I was there, Filipino family. They're willing to put me up again when I'm out there. You know, it's fantastic. They give up the beds for you. You sleep in my bed, I'll sleep up floor. I'm like, what? No.
I think it's really fabulous that you're. It's amazing. I'm speechless actually at the generosity and motivation of you, actually, to...
Can I just say as well, Chris, it's also in local papers, and the young man went to the schools, gets him back, and talks about what he's been doing. I'll tell you a little bit about the school. That's part of the project as well, doing that.
I'm afraid we've lost your call quality again, Tony.
Yes.
You weren't right.
I know.
It's all.
Yeah, just tell them a little bit about the school as well when you went around and you got local papers and you went back with the shoeboxes and things like that.
Right, I couldn't really make out what he's saying.
No, right? Unfortunately, we can't hear you anymore, Tony. You've gone strange on us again.
I think you mentioned schools. I was going around schools in this area, showing the kids what I was doing in the Philippines. We did like shoebox appeals. Kids were getting shoeboxes, you know, putting like toothpaste in, toothbrush, sweets, like a tin tuna, tin sardines, packets of noodles, things like that. Maybe a soft toy, a little note. You know, my name's. Whatever, Emma and I'm 7 years old, Mrs. and me, a little picture. Yeah, so it was great for kids right here to show that people, that other kids in other countries, what they're going through at this time. You know, yeah. It was a great response, actually, from the kids. They were so, like, they couldn't believe it. They couldn't believe that this was going on in this day and age. Yeah. Are you there?
Yeah, I am. Yeah, I'm just trying to sort. I was just trying to think what was. It was, my mind was kind of running over what I was going to do with the editing of this because it's quite difficult not being able to hear Tony. Can't hear you at all now, Tony. You're just kind of breaking up entirely.
Yeah.
I think we got some good stuff from you there though, Christian, which I'll be able to include. I'm really sorry that I didn't press the record button.
It's all right. We got there and didn't we?
I think we did. And like I say, I think it's amazing what you're doing. I really do. I mean, I think it's really uplifting to hear that there are humans and individuals who are, you know, acting with such incredible generosity of spirit. And bravery as well, really, because, I mean, you know, it must be a very difficult place to spend your time.
I don't want any thanks. It makes me happy. What else am I going to spend my time doing?
Mm.
You know, it's a great country to go to. It is. And the people, the culture, the generosity there. So it's not all... You know, it's not all just about giving. It's just, they're a fantastic country, so it's a fantastic people and a fantastic country, so it's...
We could probably learn something from them, couldn't we?
we could learn a hell of a lot from these people, a hell of a lot, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Filipino, they're just so, oh, it's amazing. They're so caring, so loving, so generous. They are, they're a fantastic people, and as an individual country, it stands out for me. Georgia is one of the best, the best country. I feel all every, I mean, I've been to almost every one of them.
Yeah. I'm getting a load of background noise on your call now as well.
Yeah, right.
So I think probably it'd be a good idea for me to say, like, thank you very much, Christian, for joining us. I'd like to talk to you again. You know, you're on the contact list now. I'd like to talk to you when you get back, if that's possible, about what you've been doing.
Yeah, that's fine, yeah.
Because we could have a little talk then. I mean, you can bear it in mind when you're over there and, you know, come on and maybe have you on the show for half an hour talking about what you found when you're out there and what you're going to do next.
Yeah. I mean, Anthony will be coming over, won't he? So,
yeah. Well, perhaps have you both on for a bit of a chat. Is there anything you think that people over here can do to help, you know, if they've got a bit of spare resource? What's the best way of them kind of reaching out?
I mean, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because a lot of people have responsibilities here, and so a lot of people donate money. But you've got to donate to the right places, haven't you? You know, so it's, I don't know.
It is very difficult, isn't it?
What I'd like to say is, Christian, can you give him your email address, please? If anyone would like to donate a kilogram of rice, is less than 50 pence a kilo, which would feed a family for a few days. We will be totally transparent about everything that happens out there, and that we will put it online. We'll come on. Christian gets receipts for everything. We're not your normal type of charity. We promise we will deliver what we say we will.
Yeah, we blog everything. We log everything. We show everyone that, because I do get donations, and we log everything. Show everyone where every penny has gone, because I don't need any money. So, you know, it's every penny what people donate. Like I said, 50p a kilo, less than 50p a kilo for a kilo of rice. So
are you hammering away on your keyboard again, Tony?
No.
No, you're not.
I forgot to put my mic on mute, sorry.
Right, that's okay. It's because it's the call quality has degenerated over the last 5 or 10 minutes or so, I think, and we're getting a little bit of background noise as well.
Yeah.
That last bit you said came out really clear. I'm going to have a nightmare editing job here.
Yeah, fantastic. Great. Brilliant.
And it would be really...
Thank you very much, Nick. Really, a big thank you.
Well, thank you for coming on, Tony. It's always a pleasure talking to you. And thanks to you as well, Christian. And it would be good perhaps to have you on for a chat when you come back from the Philippines and hear what was going on.
Yeah, definitely. Without any doubt, definitely. Thanks for having me.
No problem. It's brilliant, mate. Thanks for coming on. And like I say, I'll...
And the projects I've got coming up, Nick, I think is better off doing is we'll leave that till the end of the show when we have a catch-up when we come back from the Philippines, so we can tell you what else is going on.
Absolutely great. That's brilliant, because I think we've got more than enough stuff to fill a radio show there.
We've been on about 4.5 hours, Nick.
Yeah. Well, if the three of us can get back together again when you're back out of the Philippines, that would be really good. It would.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks, Christian.
No problem. Right then. Okay.
Thanks a lot, Christian. I'll perhaps see you in the chat box on Thursday night. And best of luck, mate. And I'll take my hat off to the pair of you. I really do. I really do. Thanks, it's amazing hearing what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah. No problem. We're only doing what we think anybody else would do if they could do it.
I guess if everybody was doing that, we really wouldn't have so much trouble in the world, would we?
Well, it's not about what we're doing. It's about what people can do in the local communities, which Christian's doing as well back home where we're from. Helping at Christmas, he went round, helping pick up donations, carpets, furniture, clothes, dropping it off to people who would have otherwise had a really, really bad Christmas. So my hat's off to him big time.
Amazing. You find any time to have a job, Christian?
Yeah, well, you know, you won't even have me well enough here, guys.
And Nick, you know what I'm like? Christian's just the same as me. We're actually just a pair of hooligans.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm just trying to cement my place in heaven.
Yeah, that's what I said to someone the other day. I said, I'm just building up my brownie points.
You're my kind of hooligans, the pair of you, and I'll tell you what, they really make me think that I should visit Burnley.
Oh, yeah, big thank you. And, yeah, Christian, when I went out with Tabali, I knew my intentions, took them football strips out, and that set me up. And like I was saying to you, Nick, you know, me and Christian have never done any projects together, but we've always kept an eye. We've known each other since we were 13 years old, and we've never done anything together, but we've always kept an eye on what we've been doing and both supported each other. And, yeah, it's fantastic we're going to be doing something together.
Brilliant. Well, it'd be interesting to see what comes from that, won't it?
Yeah, I'm really happy. Chris, I can't wait to meet up with you, mate.
I know. Looking forward to it, pal.
Yeah, me too. I'm welling up and all.
Brilliant. Okay, well...
I'll get me tea now.
Yeah, you're going to have your tea and have a quiet weep and stuff, and I'll talk with you when you're back from the Philippines.
No
worries. It's quarter past 3 in the morning for me, so I'll be going to bed.
Well... Thanks a lot, guys. I really appreciate it, and all the best for your work over there, and I look forward to speaking with you when you come back.
Okay.
Yeah, thank you very much, Nick. Cheers for doing this for us.
No problem. It's going to take me between now and Thursday to edit the sodding thing. Brilliant. I'll speak with you soon, guys. Thanks a lot, folks.
Thanks, Nick. Cheers. Yeah. More on that one, Paul.
Bye-bye. Speak to you soon.
All right. See you later, guys.
See you later, folks. Well, you've been listening to Dr. Rock speaking with Tony, also known to the world as Computer Thugs, and Christian about their activities out in exotic climes. If anybody's interested in learning a little bit more about Tony's Bali Study Club, then you can go to www.bali-study-club.com. I guess it might be worth mentioning that if anybody knows anybody in a registered charity who's operating out in the Philippines who might be able to get Christian and Tony access to their container full of aid, then that'd be really good. Obviously, any other help that can be given would also be much appreciated. I'd just like to say that these are really cracking examples of what can happen when we choose to follow our dream, follow our heart. I've been told by many people that this is the way to make things turn out for yourself and for the people around you. And I think the last 3 hours or so have been a pretty sound testament to that. So thanks very, very much to my guests, Tony and Christian. Thanks to everybody, all of you out there in the chat box this evening for being there. And thanks, of course, to peoplesinternetradio.com. for letting me continue to come on and do this. You've been listening to Dr. Rock's radio show. I think we've got just about enough time for a couple of tunes. And also, Tony's asked me to put out a little recording he sent me of thanks to all of the people that have been helping him doing what he's doing out there. So I'll do that as well before the end of the show. And hopefully, if all goes well, I'll be with you again next week.
Yes, so before we go, I'd like to say a big thank you, Dr. Rock, Nick, for having us on the radio and giving us some airtime. And I would also like to say thank you to all my friends and family who have supported me, all the team at Rusty Tub, who is helping with software developments, things that we need while we're setting these places up. I'd like to say thank you to Karen and Ian, who's been a rock while I've been here. And big thank you to all the volunteers that came to Bali and helped with the project. Too many to name. Over 30 of them in total for Bali Study Club. I'd like to say thank you to the hospital, for allowing me to go into the government hospital and set up an English course while I've been here for 4 months. I would like to say thank you to Fountain Park Shopping Mall, which is being built at the moment, and they've agreed to sponsor me for my future projects. They also helped pay for my flight home so I could renew my passport and see my family and my son that I haven't seen for 2 years. And there'll be a lot more to come when we come back, and you've invited us back on to do a follow-up, so thank you very much. And I'd like to say thank you, Christian, for doing what you've been doing, and keep pushing, and you've got a heart of gold. Okay, thank you very much, and we'll speak to you soon.